Welcome, folks. This is the Ontolog invited speaker presentation. Today we have Dr. Benjamin Gosoff. It's Thursday, June 20th, 2013. Dr. Gosoff will be talking about rule-log, highly expressive yet scalable logic, enabling cost-efficient ontologies. Dr. Gosoff is really an industry leader in knowledge representation, reasoning, and acquisition. I think we've all followed his work through the years. He's pioneered semantic technologies and industry standards for rules, and then combination of rules with ontologies and rule applications, and especially in e-commerce and policies, and the acquisition of rules and ontologies from natural language. He's had driving roles in RuleML, the W3C RIF rule interchange format standard, especially the RL dialect, if you will, rule-based for rule-based ontologies. He's been involved in many inventions in knowledge representation. We may know him from, you know, courteous to feasibility, and restraint-bounded rationality, sweet rules, etc. Recently, he left Vulcan, where he had been working for many years, since 2007, under the knowledge-based systems research group there, focusing on SILK, which is a highly expressive yet scalable rule language. And before that, he was IT professor at MIT Sloan, and a senior scientist at IBM Research. Currently, he's president of Benjamin Gosoff and Associates, and involved in other affiliated groups. I'd like you to welcome Dr. Gosoff, and Dr. Gosoff, we'll let you start your presentation. Star 7 to unmute if you're muted.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I want to thank Leo for that nice introduction, and also Peter Yim very much for inviting and instigating this session. So I'm pleased today to be able to tell you about work by myself. This presentation is also authored largely by Paul Haley, one of my collaborators, and really reflects the work of a large team of people who have worked on the research ideas here from the knowledge representation, also knowledge acquisition and piloting work. I'll give a list of acknowledgments at the end, but a lot of these people were people in the effort that was done on Halo Advanced Research while I was at Vulcan, but also stretching back sideways and previously as well to folks in RuleML and Semantic Web Services framework effort and some other things as well. So what I'm going to be talking about today is really a new approach at the level of fundamental logic to the semantic web. So I think in the past we've all been accustomed to the idea that you could either pick something highly expressive or you could pick something that scaled well computationally or was practical in the sense of extending legacy technologies. And I'm here to tell you, you can have your cake and eat it too, to some degree, or at least there's a very good prospect of this in a lot of ways. So this being an ontology audience, I'm going to focus the kind of tilt of the talk to a greater extent around ontologies than when this work was last presented, which was at the Semantic Technology and Business Conference, known as Semtech Biz, in San Francisco earlier this month. If you could please advance to slide 2, appreciate that. While you're doing that, I just want to mention that another affiliation of myself and my co-author Paul is Coherent Knowledge Systems, which is a new startup, and I'll tell about that soon. Okay, so let's start by talking about what are some requirements on logical knowledge representation and reasoning, that is KRR, in order to enable a practical job of knowledge acquisition of logical knowledge that is expressively fairly complex. So I'm going to use rich as a short phrase for fairly expressively complex. All right, now, why do we care about expressively rich knowledge? Well, one big reason is that business users, much of the world's knowledge, most of the world's most valuable knowledge, if you think about our scientific, engineering, governmental, and other cultural heritage, comes in natural language. Read books, articles, the web, etc. All right, so as a target for text interpretation, one really needs a lot of expressiveness. And the natural mapping for interpreting text is in terms of at least higher order logic. Now you could order, you could also argue that you need defeasibility, you need probabilistic, maybe fuzziness, etc. But it's pretty clear after decades of study that you need at least the power of classical logic without the restriction of first order, at least syntactically. The second is that for various practical reasons, you want the logic to be able to handle exceptions and change in a graceful manner. Now, technically, I think most of the people on this call have heard of defeasibility, logical non-monotonicity, etc. So I'm going to use that to mean exactly knowledge can have exceptions, that is, be defeated, for example, by higher priority knowledge, or if there's a conflict in the sense of two pieces of information pushing for contradictory conclusions, that they fight it to a standstill or a stalemate and defeat each other. So we can think of the first as a kind of refutation and the second as a kind of rebuttal, to make an analogy to debate in legal argumentation, for example. Now, okay, so why is defeasibility so crucial? Well, first of all, most knowledge is arrived at empirically. So it may be induced in some automated manner, or it's the result of people having induced this in the sense of inductive learning over days or perhaps millennia. So knowledge that comes from science in particular is falsifiable. A lot of practical knowledge that you base your actions on can be thought of as a kind of policy about what you should do under various circumstances. So if you're representing causal processes and if you're doing hypothetical reasoning of a what-if type, often that's counterfactual. If I hadn't swerved around that piece of debris in the left lane, I would have blown out my tire, or if that person hadn't stepped back off the curb, I would have hit them. So to represent change in the knowledge and also change in the world, we need defeasibility. Now, there's another reason to think about this in semantic web context specifically, which is that our knowledge bases evolve over time. We fix errors, we clarify conclusions, we discover contradictory conflicts when we attempt to combine knowledge that's been drawn from multiple sources, authored by different people in different organizations who may be working in different contexts and have left some of that context implicit or tacit because it never occurred to them to try to make it explicit. So because of that and the other factors that I just mentioned, there's a social aspect, not just a computational aspect of scalability. That is, we wish to be able in semantic web vision to have a whole bunch of different people, a lot of breadth of contributors and users, and not just individuals, but also organizations and domains or realms and types of usage for knowledge. And we'll call that social scalability. So defeasibility has been long recognized as something that's really critical for representing all these different aspects, the empirical character of knowledge, causality and what-ifing, and More lately, it's been very much recognized as something that's very important in evolution and combination of knowledge bases. And I think this is fairly well established in the industry. Over the last 15 years, there have been technologies which have not done an incredibly good job in terms of computational scalability or reaching really wide deployment, but certainly have achieved a lot of mind share around defeasibility. So one of the things we'll see is that things are much more ready for prime time on the defeasibility front than they were before. So I'll come back to that later. Now, another aspect, of course, is that we'd like inferencing and logic to be computationally scalable. So what does scalable really mean? People argue about this. In the OWL community, for example, a lot of people say, well, the basic criteria is decidability, that is, it should return finitely, because that tends to be correlated with it doesn't take too long that often. Other people, especially from the database community or just generally other parts of AI and computer science, often say, well, decidability isn't really enough. We want polynomial time if we're going to scale out to web scale kinds of things. We don't want stuff much worse than about quadratic or linear. And we really want things to be polynomial time in the worst case. Now, some evidence for this is provided by the fact that SQL, which is what the world structured IT still revolves around primarily, and also Sparkle, which is similar semantically to SQL, and is kind of SQL redone from a fundamental expressiveness viewpoint. They're pretty much equivalent. Both have this character of being tractable if there is a bounded length on the size of a query. So we could talk formally about there being a constant upper bound on the number of distinct logical variables appearing, for example, in a declarative logic program. And I'll return to that. But I'm not going to get deep into complexity theory. I just want to make the observation that the world's structured IT runs on stuff that, in this sense, is tractable. That is worst-case poly time. Moving ahead to slide 3. All right, well, there's been big problems in the past with rich logical knowledge in the sense that the basic logic for doing knowledge representation and the reasoning techniques for it, so we'll call that the basic KRR that people are working off of, has not been defeasible and tractable. That is, it has not combined the three characteristics of having richness in the sense of at least higher order classical logic formula syntax and either defeasibility or tractability. People have not had that to work with. And that's been the case even when such KR was not the target of doing text-based knowledge acquisition. That is, just when doing whatever type of logical reasoning. So the two big closest candidates here are the main two families of logics. First of all, first-order logic. Second of all, declarative logic programs, which is the logic that relational databases and Sparkle are based on, as well as pure Prolog, and which has been very well studied and very well understood from a theoretical viewpoint, especially for over 20 years. Now, the biggest problem with the first problem I'll talk about for a first-order logic or classical-based stuff, and this goes for higher-order logic that extends FOL as well and applies to OWL and Common Logic, CL I've abbreviated it as here, and SBVR in its current form, which is founded on Common Logic as its back end, is that you often end up in a situation where you infer garbage. Let's say you have a billion axioms, and three of them contradict each other. That is, they form a minimal conflict set. Well, then anything is entailed. Every literal, every formula that is expressible in the classical logic is entailed. In other words, you infer garbage. You can't distinguish between stuff that intuitively is contradiction from the price of tea in China. One way to think about this is even non-computer scientists can tell you that as you scale up systems to anything remotely resembling web scale, you're certain to have conflict from errors, from confusions, and from tacit context if your syntax is rich and getting you into a situation where there is syntactically the potential for contradictory conflict. So in short, classical logic is perfectly brittle. That is, it breaks instantly. It's zero tolerance with respect to such conflict, whether it is from human error, from confusion, or tacit context, or you can think about other ways why you get such contradictory conflicts. Now, if you're doing pure mathematics, this perfection, this zero tolerance, is a good thing. It's a feature, not a bug. The problem is in attempting to make use of classical logic for other kinds of information modeling and reasoning and information processing needs. So classical has deep difficulties here, and this is one reason why we don't see classical logic, in my view, this is one reason why one doesn't see classical logic being used to nearly the degree that declarative logic programs are in databases and so on. Now, the second category of difficulty that one runs into, and this happens in classical logic with logical functions, and it happens in declarative logic programs if, as one does not do in databases, but one does do in pure prolog, if one permits logical functions and relies on them fairly heavily to represent things like recursion, is that one can get computational runaway, that is, via recursion through the logical functions. And this is a fundamental difficulty of the logic. It's not just the difficulty of the inferencing procedures. It can be that even a simple, small set of axioms implies that for a given simple query, there's an infinite number of answers. So let me give you just a very simple example of that. If I assert that zero is a number, and that the successor of a number, where successor is a logical function, is a number if x is a number. So if a number x is a number, then the successor of x is a number. And now I query, what's a number? There's an infinite set of answers. Zero, successor of zero, successor of successor of zero, successor of successor of successor of zero, etc., etc. All right, so that is a fundamental characteristic of the logic. And people have cracked their heads for decades on attempting to recognize and analyze termination difficulties and to develop techniques to ameliorate non-termination in logic programs with functions, where they are used fairly heavily. And, of course, this is an issue in functional programming languages as well. Now, one way to think about this is that there is as soon as you introduce a single logical function that has arity more than zero into the logical language, all of a sudden the set of things that you can talk about, the set of ground terms, becomes infinite. And so the set of conclusions to consider in declarative logic programs or classical logic becomes infinite as well. Next slide, slide 4. So in short, we have this central challenge. How to have knowledge be rich and be able to be a flexible target for modeling of information that starts out life more or less as text, that is, as natural language, and how to make it tractable, and also how to make it defeasible, and also how to combine those two characteristics at the same time. So how do we get these three characteristics all at once? This has been a central challenge in logical KRR for decades, and it has not been achieved until now. Now there is a new rich logic. It is based by extending the logic of databases. That is, it is based on extending the normal type of declarative logic programs, pure prolog in short. It is not based on classical logic, although it looks syntactically pretty close to classical logic for the heart of it. What it does is it extends LP, that's what we'll use as a short phrase for normal declarative logic programs. It transforms into LP. Its semantics is defined by a set of fairly simple local transformations into LP, and it is implemented in the current engines that we have available for it, and there are a couple now, by such transformation into LP. And this logic is called RULOG, and so that's what's in the title of the talk. RULOG is an homage to the name Datalog, which is the name for LP restricted to the function-free case. LP restricted to not permit functions of arity 1 or greater is the logic of databases, SQL and Sparkle, and with that restriction on functions relaxed, that is, with functions permitted, is the logic of pure prolog. The reason why it's called logic programs is because people studied it in the context of pure prolog and relating it to the logic of databases. Now, a number of years ago, there was an ad campaign, which many of you from the United States may recall, which said, the world runs on Oracle. Now, basically, that was not quite true, but it is true that the world runs on declarative LP. It runs on LP because it runs on relational, et cetera, type databases. So if we think in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, in practical structured information management today, LP is the 99%, not FOL. Even though when people learn logic in school, in math classes and so on, and when they often when they learn the logical foundations of computer science, they learn FOL first, and it certainly is useful for mathematics, but it's kind of niche. For most practical purposes, LP is where the action is. Now, some more evidence and or ramification of that, depending on how one views it, is in the area of business rules. So there is a billion-dollar plus sector, about $1 billion to vendors, and several times that in terms of other customer spend around business rules of a, what we'll call it, a production rules type flavor. So they might either literally be production rules, or they might be event condition action rules, which are very similar to production rules. And if you look at production rules and you analyze what their expressive power is from a declarative viewpoint, that is, without considering so much the blow-by-blow agenda and succession of states aspect in production rules, they have expressive power pretty similar to Datalog. Datalog with negation is failure. Now, in short, we're starting from the thing that is the 99% of practical structured info management today. This logic RULOG has been developed over a series of extension steps that draws on research over the last 20 years. RULML, F-Logic, Courteous Logic Programs, Defeasible Logic, Situated and Production Logic Programs, HiLog, aggregation operators, a number of other things, as we'll see shortly. But what I'm trying to hammer here is that the foundation is the foundation of stuff that people are already using, that they've been working with for decades, that is non-classical. RIF is defined primarily via a framework, the W3 Rule Interchange Format Standard, and there's the, what's called the Framework for Logic Dialects. The other dialects are defined as specialization of that framework. One of the first dialects, I think it was the first dialect that was drafted as instance of a dialect of RIF that was not done by the RIF working group itself, which finished up its work in 2009, was the RULOG dialect. And at that time it was called SILC. It also was previously known as Hyperlogic Programs. And it has recently been updated and still needs more work, but it is being done in cooperation by especially people working as part of RULML, and is a draft of a submission as a note to W3C, which is essentially the process going forward after the working group for how new RIF dialects get defined and standardized. Now, as many of you might know, the RULML people were the heart of the people doing the work on the RIF standard, and RIF was based design-wise primarily on RULML as a design. So it's good to have the imprimatur of W3C. OASIS also recognizes RULML's key role in standards design. There's a legal RULML effort being done in OASIS to apply RULML in the legal area. And so RULML is kind of where the action is as far as defining industry standards and substance currently and going forward, as it has been for the last number of years. Now, one of the key things that makes RULOG practical, which is progress as compared to where RULOG with somewhat less expressiveness and RULOG in other ways was several years ago, is that there are a number of new reasoning techniques to implement it, including in pretty much its full glory. Those were developed mostly in the form of open source software, Flora 2 and XSB. XSB is a fairly clean prolog, an ISO prolog also. And then some additional functionality was done on top of that, including UI, knowledge interchange, and certain kind of latest, greatest extensions in the RULOG expressiveness itself in the SILC system that was done at Vulcan. There is now, the SILC effort at Vulcan is now over, but the team is very excited about RULOG and continuing to work on it and is in process of forming a new startup called Coherent Knowledge Systems. So let's move on to the next slide, slide 5. Okay, so let me give some sense of what are the key technical aspects of RULOG, and this may give some appreciation for why it's taken a number of years to develop RULOG. One aspect is defeasibility. So defeasibility as a characteristic to extend LP was developed by a number of different efforts. There were ideas put forward. There was one basic idea which turned out to be most practical and was invented twice, just like there was one basic idea about how to extend the syntax of first-order logic to be most practical, which is to be higher order, that is the high log extension, which is in Flora and F-Logic and is also in Common Logic. So there's a similar idea of courteous defeasibility, which is very similar to defeasible logic. And so if you look at the work that is done at the RULML conferences and symposia over the years, you see lots of work on defeasibility there that is mainly oriented around that approach. And those two are very closely related to each other. There are some papers that talk about that. I'm not going to get into all the detail. What was developed later, however, is a much more efficient and flexible way, and also, it turns out, a more powerful expressively way to incorporate the feasibility into the logic. And this is the idea of a certain type of argumentation theory, so-called, where there are some meta rules, order a small number of tens of such meta rules that specify the principles of debate, and thus when rules have exceptions. This enables prioritized conflict handling, ensures consistency of conclusions, and is a considerable advance from the point of view of analysis and providing semantic guarantees, as well as efficient and flexible implementation and powerful expressiveness, this meta-rule approach. And this meta-rule approach is based on the high log extension in part, and also on having rule IDs be explicitly treated within the language syntactically and semantically. Something that we all take for granted when we look at an implemented rule system is that you have such rule IDs. But interestingly, most logics, including classical logic, don't treat them explicitly. Once you do, which you really need in order to talk about one rule or a group of rules having higher priority than another one for defeasibility, once you have that, turns out you can use it for some other things. But it's very useful to specify the principles of defeat or debate themselves using higher order rules that also talk about these rule IDs. The second major extension in RULOG is a semantically clean form of bounded rationality that gets past this either-or aspect of either you can have a lot of expressive power in terms of convenience of things like higher order syntax and classical formulas, classical-looking formulas, or you can have computational scalability a la tractability, but you can't have both. This form of bounded rationality is called restraint, and what it does is it leverages the third truth value, which is called undefined, or U for short, which was already present in LP, well-founded LP, which in the propositional case is tractable. And it leverages it for a new purpose. So the previous purpose is a kind of oscillatory instability, or there's no way you can figure it out because it's paradoxical aspect of certain types of cyclic dependency through negationist failure, NAF. So, for example, if you have a P colon dash NAF P, that leads to P being having the undefined truth value. So that was already present in LP. But what restraint does is it extends this spirit and technical characteristic of well-foundedness in LP to represent not bothering, either because you don't want to or because you can't for some reason, which may be for practical, computational, or information access reasons. You don't want to bother. You may know that you don't care. And this is a characteristic that people are very aware of introspectively about their own meta-knowledge, about their own reasoning, or about the reasoning of others, is that, oh, we're not going to go there. We're just not going to think about that so hard. We're not going to figure out whether it's true or false. And here false means either in the sense of strong negation or in the sense, more fundamentally, of negation as failure type negation. So argumentation theories and restraint are described at the basic levels in a couple of key papers. You can look at the Coherent website, for example, the Coherent Knowledge Systems website publication page, and find those papers very easily there. You can find them some other places on the web as well, as is the case for the other references on this page. So next, let me talk about omniformity. So that is a form of being able to give logical formulas that mention disjunction and existentials, and not just in the bodies of rules, but in the heads of LP-looking type rules. So we preserve in RULOG the LP type of basic :- implication connective, which you could think of as a kind of directed implication, but also permit one to write formulas that have empty bodies and just a head and look just like a higher order logic formula. And then there's an issue of, okay, well, how is disjunction in the head to be treated? How are existentials in the head to be treated? I'm not going to be able to get into all the technical details about that, but there is an idea which was developed almost a decade ago now called omnidirectional disjunction. And the basic spirit of that is that if you can rule out the other cases in a disjunction, then you've narrowed it down to one case, to the one remaining case. In the case of existentials, they're treated via scolemization. There's a certain amount of interaction between scolemization and disjunction as one reduces, that is, transforms a higher order logic formula in RULOG into a form of rules that become ultimately normal LP through a series of steps, semantically and also, as I mentioned, algorithmically, which mostly happens during at load time right now and is a pretty quick operation per rule. Now, omniformity avoids general reasoning by cases. That's the spirit of LP in general. That's the spirit of rule log. And that's similar to unit resolution in classical logic. It is possible to reintroduce selectively reasoning by cases, but one key, along with restraint, to ensuring that one can preserve tractability, that is, computational scalability, worst-case polynomial time, if you want it. So it's dial your own polytime, is one way to think about it intuitively, is this avoidance of doing unrestricted reasoning by cases. So this combination of don't do unrestricted reasoning by cases and let one specify using rules within the logic when one does not want to go there, when one does not want to bother to figure out truth values. Say, I don't want to have the answers about number of successor of successor of successor of successor of successor past, say, 100 such successors, or maybe past 3 such successors, I say, etc. That combination of restraint and avoidance of general reasoning by cases, which is often known as an intuitionistic property of logics that are extending or similar in this regard to LP, RULOG included, intuitionistic plus restraint is what is the key to computational scalability of RULOG. Now, one of the interesting things about RULOG is that because it has FOL type form and, as it were, LP type guts brought together, it is an umbrella KR that enables sound interchange of knowledge with all the major standards for semantic web knowledge. So one could show formally that if you're reasoning defeasibly and you have contradictions, well, remember classically you get garbage, so you get every conclusion. So if you're doing something reasonable that is defeasible, you're getting a subset of all those conclusions, so you're just sound. And because if you start without negation as failure, you can do all the non-monotonic reasoning you want to do practically using defeasibility, which does not require explicit NAF, other than in this background few set of meta-rules about argumentation theory, all of the domain, et cetera, or even common sense knowledge that one has can be expressed without use of the NAF connective, and defeasibility takes care of what you need in terms of doing non-monotonic reasoning. And so the knowledge that one specifies in RULOG can be without pain specified without using explicit NAF for most information modeling purposes. What that means is then every time you look at a rule, you can just think of it as classical looking. And it turns out that Rulog behaves, as I said, soundly, although incompletely relative to classical. Incompletely because of restraint and this intuitionistic character that I just talked about. Now, a lot of the action about making Rulog practical over the last number of years has been to develop reasoning techniques based on extending tabling in LP inferencing. And that includes techniques for truth maintenance. So-called tabled prologs actually maintain internally essentially things like database views and are doing a combination of forward and backward reasoning. That is, when you do a query, it keeps the work that was done on that query, not just at the top level, but the sub-goals that were worked on during the process of doing the inferencing, whether they failed or succeeded, and then those are reused for later queries, if one wants them to be. And that's typically a useful thing to do because it speeds up computation. In particular, that speeds up the process of interactive knowledge acquisition and editing, because as one tweaks the knowledge base, one can quickly interactively do an edit test loop, because testing is quick because lots of previous conclusions are kept around. Another set of techniques have to do with extracting, depending on how one thinks about it, justifications from the inferencing. And those include why not, also from a kind of a more detailed viewpoint, doing trace analysis to help debug knowledge acquisition. There are other techniques for preventing some mechanical aspects of runaway, which prolog systems and classical reasoning systems have often suffered in the past, such as term abstraction. Other techniques for optimization or ensuring termination and ensuring that restraint can be performed well, then involve dynamically reordering subgoals. So there's a lot of technical depth and substance to the proof theory for Rulog, which draws on a rich set of research and development that has been done in the area of LP and its extensions, and also to a lesser but significant extent from FOL and certain other areas. So if you'd like more information about Rulog, a great place to look are a couple of forthcoming RuleML papers, and also a rules tutorial that is going to be presented at AAAI. And preprint or preliminary versions of all those references listed on this page are available at the Coherent Knowledge Systems website. Moving on to slide 6, let's take a look at an example. I know this has been kind of thick at the logical level and abstract, but we're talking really about what I view and a number of other people who've been working on this and starting to use it, view as a generational change in the foundational logic for semantic technology and really much of computer science. So we have to spend a certain amount of time abstractly. Let's take a look at a little example here. And I've selected an example which illustrates some of the issues involved in being able to exploit the power of the logic for purposes of doing knowledge integration that requires ontological mapping. So a very large sector of the economy of the world involves doing financial reporting from companies. And much of the financial regulators and industry and investment analysis ecosystem revolves around financial reporting, sometimes called business reporting. So let's consider an example of the sorts of issues that really come up there. I was a junior financial analyst 1 year in college, working at a company that specialized in bank stocks. And it was a family business founded by my granduncle who helped arranged the merger of Chase Bank with Manhattan Bank to form Chase Manhattan, which is now was then merged with J.P. Morgan to form Morgan Chase. And I discovered when I was a junior analyst that all the action in the bank annual reports for doing ratio analysis was in the footnotes. Oh, we sold a headquarters building, and we put that in our, into our earnings, and so that's why our earnings looked reasonable this year, because otherwise we were taking a bath on South American bad loans to Brazil or whatever. Back in the 70s, I'm old now. Here's a more modern example. Say there's a company, BB, that reports its operating earnings, and it includes as part of its operating costs to subtract from its operating revenue the R&D operating cost category, and puts into that category of R&D operating costs the price of a small company which BB acquired for the sake of that small company's intellectual property. And you have another organization that wants to view company BB's reporting. And it wants to use somewhat different definitions. It wants to use, say, a more conventional definition that includes that acquisition amount. Now, BB has done what's called pro forma reporting. It's actually quite reasonable because you treat expenditures on R&D for building intellectual property to treat acquisition of a small company acquired for the sake of its intellectual property as in a manner similar to your other R&D expenditures, but GG doesn't want to do that. It wants to exclude that acquisition amount. So the rules on this slide specify a contextual ontological mapping. So the first rule, the at sign here, declares a rule tag. Normally bring over is the name of a handle, essentially, on a rule that we're going to see shortly is used for specifying priority between rules that are defeasible. So in short, what this first rule says is normally, if an item belongs to a certain category, question mark, prefix is a logical variable here, according to GG, then, according to BB, then it's brought over and treated as in that same category according to GG. So that item ends up as categorized according to GG in the same category, question mark, C-A-T-E-G, as it was by BB. However, the next rule says, colon, here means subclass of. If that category, according to GG, is a subcategory of operating, that is, if it's a subcategory of operating stuff, revenues, earnings, costs, etc., then, and it's an acquisition, then it's not in that category. It's a non-operating item. So any acquisition is not going to be operating according to GG. And that's what the second rule says. Its handle is acquisitions are not operating. The third rule says that the second rule overrides the first rule. Insofar as they conflict, which they do about this operating cost item for the acquisition from BB, then the second rule that it is not to be treated as the same category in GG as it was in BB kicks in. So then the rest of the example here, I'm not going to go through all the details. Basically, you have some R&D salaries, some R&D overhead. They have certain amounts. They total 40 mil, and the price of the acquired company was 30 mil, and according to BB, the R&D operating cost was 70 mil, but according to GG, it's going to be 40 mil because the acquisition item is going to be excluded. So this is a small example of the sort of thing that systems do all the time today at massive, massive scale. Okay, so moving on, one of the interesting things that I mentioned before is that this expressive richness in RULOG enables one to start from English, from natural language. So what we've got here is a new approach that has been developed that leverages RULOG that was piloted in great part in the Vulcan Silk effort and is continuing to be pursued by companies now looking at doing this commercially, notably Coherent, but also there's some other players involved here, which is that one can go from text, effectively unrestricted English text, and similar things can be done for other languages, other natural languages, into English in the way of text interpretation, and then it's considerably simpler to do a halfway decent job of text generation. Now, textual logic is an approach which uses logic itself to specify the mappings from text to logic and from logic to text. Logic to text is important, especially for viewing knowledge that didn't start out life in text, say that got generated logically from inferencing. For example, in volume, often when one is looking at justifications or explanations of answers. There are a couple of key ideas or elements to this textual logic approach as it's been being pursued. The first is very related to ontology, and that's the idea of textual terminology. Here, words, or more generally word senses, are directly used as logical constants. Each word sense is used directly as a logical constant. Best thought of as a high log functor, if you know what that is. If you don't worry about it. Just think of it as a logical function or predicate, and don't get hung up on that. The second is that, and here's where rubber really starts to hit the road, is that each phrase in text, each English phrase, a noun phrase, a verb phrase, prepositional phrase, adverbially modified noun phrase, et cetera, corresponds one-to-one to a logical term. All right, so that is a really key point. A phrase corresponds to a logical term. So we could call this phrasal style of knowledge. What's interesting about this is then the ontology that one is using at the logical level in the sense of the vocabulary of terms that one's rules and knowledge are built up out of emerges automatically and naturally right out of the English that the logic is representing. And we'll see some examples of this shortly. The second major element is that there is a relatively rapid technique for logical disambiguation that has been developed. The insights here include what is it important to focus on in doing logical disambiguation in order to achieve a reasonably deep and complete capture of the knowledge that is in a given sentence. What's treated includes the parse, the type, and scope of the quantifiers for all versus there exist, or more generally, you could think in terms of what are called linguistic quantifiers, which are essentially in spirit either universal or existential. Coreference, in the sense of what a noun phrase that is referential, such as it or she or the ball, refers to, as well as something that people often hear disambiguation mentioned in conjunction with, namely to distinguish between different word senses. It turns out that for somewhat particular domains, most words have one dominant word sense, but for many common words, that's much more of an issue. So throw might mean to give up, like throw the game. Or it might mean to propel, for example. Or it might mean to raise an error in computer science. Now, what this interactive logical disambiguation technique does is it leverages a lexical ontology that does parsing plus a certain amount of semantic interpretation. There's an existing large vocabulary broad coverage one called English Resource Grammar, which is a wonderful resource, has hundreds of thousands of axioms in it. Roughly owlish in expressiveness, the lexical ontology itself. And this interactive logical disambiguation technique is initially restricted, but not very essentially restricted, to standalone sentences. We'll see that. And it's a good idea to minimize ellipsis that is missing words, as well as rhetoric and heavy use of metaphor, etc. And there is a tool called Automata Linguist that implements this, and it's pretty exciting that it works so well. What we also do in textual logic is to leverage the feasibility of the logic itself, as we've been talking about. Now, this is important not just for the content that one would be capturing from natural language, but also to represent natural language processing, that is, the mappings themselves that do text interpretation and text generation. Peter Clark, my former colleague at Vulcan, who's an expert in natural language, had a great phrase. The thing about NL is that there's a gazillion special cases, so that has an immediate kind of implication. Now, in Vulcan Silk, the goal was to try to work up from modeling by a single domain expert to a small team of domain and knowledge engineer type experts, and ultimately someday to digital Aristotle with very wide authoring of knowledge, and then use this to answer logical queries and to answer textual queries and do pedagogy and then support research. Watson.
We'll be on slide 8 now.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That was slide 8. Sorry about that. Moving ahead to slide 9 quickly. Watson talks about this trade-off of you can either have massive knowledge in logical form deeply understood, you can't get it, but you could do it shallowly and do things statistically, but then you lack precision, depth, and understanding. So wouldn't it be great, moving on to slide 10, if it was cheap in some reasonable sense of significantly cheaper or cheap enough for a lot of purposes to acquire massive volumes of knowledge that are formally encoded as logical formulas? What if it was easy enough to understand natural language questions well enough to exploit those formal encodings? In other words, what we'd really like is to get past this kind of limitation that we see in Watson and Google and Siri and other things that people are rightly very excited about in AI, where they lack the accuracy and the depth of understanding and the explainability. Moving on to slide 11. So we did an experiment at the end of the Silk effort, which was to represent the knowledge of one chapter of a popular college-level science textbook at the first-year college level. Biology is nowadays the most popular subject taken in college in the U.S., and this is the most popular textbook for biology in the U.S. By Campbell et al., and we took one of the earlier but not the earliest chapters called Chapter 7 on Cell Membranes. A relatively early one was chosen just to reduce the amount of background prerequisite knowledge about biology and chemistry and so on needed to encode the knowledge in that chapter. The second goal was to measure what the productivity in KA was could be achieved by the knowledge engineers doing the KA, to assess how much labor, the quality of the resulting logic, and how much of the knowledge in a textbook was covered by the knowledge base that was acquired. The software that was used is listed here. I've mentioned it already. Nobody is a subset of Automata Linguist. The results were pretty interesting. Moving on to slide 12. Several thousand sentences were captured with several hundred questions. Some of the sentences were directly encoded from English into logic from the textbook. Some of the sentences were reformulated somewhat. I'll talk about that process. We called that articulation to make them somewhat simpler. Just to kind of break them up, because a lot of textbook sentences are written in a kind of rhetorical, narrative kind of way, and are longer than they need to be for encoding purposes. There also was quite a bit of background knowledge. The sentences that were encoded averaged 10 words in length and ranged up to 25 words. Background knowledge tended to be shorter. What was interesting is when we started, we thought, oh, we'd be specifying lots of background ontological knowledge using OWL. We found that it was actually easier for the KEs to use the tool, even in this very first pilot effort using the tool. In other words, to do text interpretation rather than to have them write OWL axioms, even though these were people who knew logic and could encode things in OWL. The disambiguation of the parse typically took considerably less than a minute. And however, just picking the top parse in automated fashion, a la statistical parser, would not have worked. It was very common for there to be hundreds of parses per sentence. The longer the sentence, the more parses you tend to get, but even for these 10-word sentences, because of the kind of exponential aspect of multiplicity in parsing interpretations, having to do with things like attachment of prepositional phrases and some words that are could be interpreted as a noun or a verb, for example, or whatever. And on average, there was over 30 parses per sentence. So typically, the correct parse was not the parse ranked best by statistical NLP or even number two. The sentences that were disambiguated and formalized took only a few minutes on average to do the first draft, and then we actually had the a collaborative review and revision process where which roughly doubled the amount of time per sentence to do KA at the level of averaged over the whole knowledge base. Now, one thing that was also interesting is that the resulting logic was typically more sophisticated than even fairly skilled logicians who had more skill as KEs than the KEs we use typically produce. Moving on to slide 13, we tracked in considerable detail all the different actions that the KEs did, right down to their individual editing actions. This slide gives a little bit of a sense of that. It's just a flash, really. Let's move on to slide 14. And we produced a knowledge base, as I mentioned, that had several thousand sentences in it. And for each of those sentences, the we see here on the left the text of the sentence, and then on the right a logical expression whose constants are the words of English. Okay, so we'll take a look at this in more detail very shortly. But one thing you might want to do later is look at this slide and zoom in, and you could look at a whole bunch of examples just of what it looks like going from the text to a bunch of different logical expressions. To a logical expression for each of them. So, for example, here, slide 15, moving on to slide 15, is the sentence, the hydrophobic tails of a phospholipid consist of a long fatty acid of long fatty acid hydrocarbon chains. So this is a roughly typical length sentence. I think it's slightly over 10 words here. The 13 in the first line actually refers to the fact that it was parse number 13. It was the 13th ranked parse by the statistical element of a parser that worked off this primarily logical set of information in the lexical ontology. It's called the PET parser, which has been extended by Automata, and Automata's technology is part of Coherence. Now, what we see here listed is a little spreadsheet-like table in which the user works to disambiguate the logical quantification and coreference aspects of the sentence, which is, in other words, to go beyond the parsing disambiguation. Not shown here is how the parsing disambiguation is done, which is actually simpler than this. So I think I'm going to show this and focus on it to give you a sense of, okay, here's the hardest part for the users, and it takes them typically a minute or two per sentence to do their first crack at this. So what do? They see a bunch of noun phrases here. We see phospholipid, tails, chain, acid, hydrocarbon. And what they do is they specify for each of them whether it's to be treated as a universal versus an existential. We see that in the second column here under a titled logic, the for all and there exist signs. And this sentence didn't use any coreference, so that's left blank here. And then there's a little bit of information shown here. And what happens is that they come up with an output interpretation, which using the additional bits of logical disambiguation information they've specified through this interactive interface generates the logical axiom that we see down below highlighted in the off-white. For all X9, phospholipid of X9 implies that for all X6, hydrophobic tail of X9 is X6, implies that, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so once one works with this a bit, one gets used to this as a knowledge engineer, and this itself can be turned back into text in a straightforward manner. What I encourage you to do is look at a two-minute video that is up on the Coherent Knowledge website on the publications page that shows a video of disambiguation being done, because you can't really get a sense of the UI and how hard or easy it is to do this without getting a sense of the sequence of steps that you look at. I just wanted to give you the flavor here of how that's done. Moving on to slide 16, in like fashion to encoding knowledge starting from a sentence as an assertion, one can encode questions. So a question is just a formula, basically. So here's the question: are the passageways provided by channel proteins hydrophilic or hydrophobic? And that can be encoded in a similar fashion. Moving on to slide 17, reasoning is done using a hypothetical mechanism. Most questions that are in this context of non-monotonic reasoning, it makes sense to think of in terms of having a presumption part and a narrow query. That is, suppose something is a passageway provided by a channel protein. Would that passageway be hydrophilic? Would it be hydrophobic? And so the reasoning that's was implemented in the Silk system, and we see a little sample of some explanation with some text generation in part having been done, mentioning some Skolem constants that were used there, just to give a bit of a peek under the covers that would normally be hidden from the users, and just we'd use terminology directly in English for mortal users, gets done using that hypothetical query plus other techniques for the justification infrastructure that I mentioned before. So here, the top level G is there's an answer, and that was based on a rule that has a certain body, and then there were some sub-goals, and that's what we're seeing very briefly shown there. Moving on to slide 18, as I mentioned before, the logic-based methods can be used to generate text from underlying logical expressions. Here's a sequence of back-chaining steps and an explanation that was done before the KA experiment. We really didn't focus on logic to text during the KA experiment itself. And we'll be getting back to that. Actually, we've started getting back to that in current work at Coherent and with other users. Moving on to slide 19. There is a commonly used taxonomy of cognitive complexity in education. And information, question answering or retrieval in terms of just doing recall all the way to doing critical thinking with organizing, identifying, and analyzing patterns. Google is basically at the bottom of this six-point scale. Watson is near the bottom. In the work on textual logic, we aimed for and actually were able to show that we could do many questions more at the middle of this six-point scale. And if you look at advanced placement or first-year college-level questions, they tend to be have a somewhat bell-shaped distribution from level one to level six. So you have most questions are somewhere near the middle of this scale, and with some being just straight recall and some being more complicated kinds of judgments or comparisons or criticisms of theories or discussions of their usefulness and so on. Here's an example of a level 4 question. If a paramecium swims from a hypotonic environment to an isotonic environment, will its contractile vacuole become more active? So basically, a vacuole is a little bit in a paramecium that can push out some liquid from inside or with a certain amount of stuff dissolved in it, which helps maintain the homeostatic balance of the paramecium with respect to its environment. And the answer is no here because as it goes to isotonic, it doesn't need to do much adjustment. Isotonic is kind of neutral or friendly with respect to saltiness or other dissolved substances. Anyway, so without getting into all the details, just to give you some flavor of you know, we could do some, and that was a real question that we did. Moving on to slide 21, we had some following other study results. As I mentioned, it took only a few minutes for each pass, and then we did a couple of passes on average via collaboration. And so it was significantly under 10 minutes on average to articulate new sentences starting from the textbook sentences and then to encode those sentences, disambiguate them, formalize them, review, and revise. To give some sense of that, there are many types of important documents, for example, business policies, law, contracts, regulations, pedagogical material, textbooks, etc., that take significantly longer than 10 minutes per sentence just to author the English once people know the content kind of in their head in some sense. So this is in the ballgame as far as being practical to pay for, and it's really a significant advance compared to a lot of previous costs for business rule authoring, which is an order of magnitude more. So we're very excited about that. I'll come back to that shortly. We did some evaluation of the coverage, also the quality of the resulting logic, which was pretty good, and some of the numbers are listed here. So there were some open issues left in this KA experiment due to the limitations of scope and resource, time frame, tooling in this experiment. Seemed that the to drive forward to do a lot more question answering testing, we'd probably involve more iterating to discover and remedy omissions or errors in the knowledge base. But the tooling and the overall process, which we're getting developed as we went, would mature, and that would reduce the effort. It's not clear how much those two net will come out in the future for different sorts of KA tasks or efforts and domains and so on. Moving on to slide 22, part of the reason why the expressive coverage was very good, really the biggest reason, was due to RULOG. There were some small issues having to do with essentially implementation about modal treatment of natural language modals were not covered well yet by the lexical parsing and by the tool. There was some other issues around numerics. Terminological coverage was also very good. There was only a small amount of handcrafted ontology of a logical sort. So very little, you know, enter stuff into protege kind of things or write it in OWL needed. There were some small shortfalls from a few miscellaneous implementation issues. And some words had to be added and information about those words that were domain-specific words to the lexical ontology, ERG, English Resource Grammar. So several hundred such lexical entries were added in order to represent the domain knowledge in the chapter, because I don't remember the exact number of words in the chapter, but I think it was a few thousand distinct words. Moving on to slide 23. So if we net-net and try to assign dollar numbers, which there's a certain amount of fuzz to, but we can definitely talk about ballpark and order of magnitude here. We have pretty confident numbers at that level. We came out at about $3 or $4 per word being expended on the KE labor. And then we could look at that per page. You know, a standard page might be defined as 250 words at 5 characters, but, you know, an actual page in a Word, Microsoft Word document, or, you know, screenful on a web page tends to vary. So ballpark, we're talking $1,000 a page. And that is about that's not cheap, but it's not ridiculous either. That is the same ballpark as the labor to author the text itself for many formal text documents. So many college science textbooks, many kinds of business or legal documents, et cetera. And as I mentioned, there's considerable uncertainty still when in future scaling this out, how much this may go down, might go up for certain types of domains or needs in terms of perfectionism of quality and what's produced, et cetera. Now, moving on to slide 24, this approach to doing KA using the logic has several major advantages. You can do interactive disambiguation with logical and semantic precision, start from effectively unconstrained text, pretty much anything you wanted to say, you could say. As I said, there were some, you know, some implementation issues for now, but the fundamental approach is extremely promising that way. And even right out of the gate, we got extremely high expressive and terminological coverage. What I think is very exciting for our ontological community is not that the need for precisely defined logical ontology to capture data schemas is going to go away, but that we'll be able to work much more flexibly with text and have a kind of sea of shallower effort of labor involved by being able to work from text phrasings rather than needing effort to specify them explicitly. And I think when we look at the area of text extraction, we see the power at scale of being able to use English words themselves as essentially the vocabulary for information processing and integration in that realm. And this textual terminology approach, our team believes, is exciting as a bridge to work in text mining and what is in the text analysis community called textual entailment, namely figuring out what sentences follow from what other sentences. RULOG is a rich target logic that can handle exceptions and change and pretty much anything that you want to say in natural language. It's tractable. It can represent pretty much most of what you want in terms of representing the text interpretation and text generation as well, although one would also like to represent probabilistic and statistical aspects and reasoning in future. RULOG supports knowledge interchange very richly, as I mentioned before, although for many of these things with expressive restrictions, especially from it into them, since it's more expressively rich than, say, function-free declarative LP-based stuff such as Sparkle or SQL or OWL. Moving on to slide 25, we believe that this is a research breakthrough on two aspects. One, rapid acquisition of rich logical knowledge, the so-called K bottleneck of AI, and two, being able to reason with the rich logical knowledge practically that results. It's early days still. Lots remains to do on the tooling. And one interesting direction here is to leverage inductive learning to aid disambiguation to make it more of a confirmation, less of an explicit specification operation, more of the time for the users, which could easily, we believe, drive down the amount of time that it takes per sentence by another order of magnitude. And to do, of course, more experiments to push on doing question answering, which we have not done a whole lot of yet. We've done quite a bit of, but not nearly at the scale we'd want to test this approach thoroughly, and generally to scale up. Moving on to slide 26, as I mentioned earlier, there's a company created to commercialize this approach called Coherent Knowledge Systems. We often call it Coherent or Coherent KS for short. Its URL is coherentknowledge.com. We went public with the website and talking about the company earlier this month. It's targeting not only the usual kind of information integration for semantic technology, but also the group of applications that we could call policy-centric around business policy, including trust and information access, as well as regulation and law and contracts and service agreements and so on. And also to support natural language, HCI, including for question answering, and ultimately conversational type, more natural interfaces, which is of great interest in the industry, especially with the rise of mobile and some paradigm shift as far as HCI generally go. Moving on to slide 27, we can recap the requirements here by saying, well, we wanted to put together doing text-based knowledge acquisition and question answering with logical KRR. Key requirements in the logical KRR were defeasibility and tractability. Key requirement in text-based is to be able to do disambiguation, which has been pretty much a showstopper in the past for rich such text-based K and QA from an NLP viewpoint. Moving on to slide 28, we developed some techniques such as the interactive disambiguation, bringing the text and the logic closer together at the vocabulary and the ontological level by using logic-based mappings and this textual terminology approach, and develop techniques at the logical level that constitute RULOG that enable the feasibility and tractability. Key ideas there including the argumentation theory's approach to defeasibility, the restraint approach to bounded rationality, and that helps produce tractability, and this treatment of classical-looking formulas via omnidirectional disjunction and skolemization that constitute the omniform expressive feature in RULOG. Moving on to slide 29, those two puzzle pieces then fit together, applications can get to all this functionality through specialized UIs, through service interfaces such as web APIs or web services, as well as Java APIs, say, things like that. And then on the logical back end, resources such as databases or various kinds of services, web services, Java APIs, whatever can be accessed as well. I want to thank the people listed on this last slide, 30. This work really represents work over a number of years by a number of people, and I'm privileged to have played a leading role in much of that, but there have been a number of other people who really have led some very key aspects of this, and I particularly want to call out Paul Haley on the natural language and Michael Kiefer on a lot of the aspects of RULOG, as well as Terry Swift on a lot of the aspects at the XSB and tabled reasoning levels for their expertise, which has contributed to bringing all this together. So with that, wind up. I'm sorry I ran a little bit longer than I expected, but I think we have some time for questions. Right, Peter? Or Leo?
Yes. Thank you, Benjamin. Yeah, we're open for QA session now. So, folks, raise your hand in the chat if you have a question, and then make sure that you do a *7 to unmute.
And also, we have 34 people on the voice bridge and only 28 on the chat. If you want to participate in the Q&A segment, please get onto the chat into the chat room.
Benjamin, I'll raise the first question here. I put it in the chat room too, but it sounds like you're using kind of like higher order guards over the reasoning with this restraint plus avoidance of reasoning by cases. Is that something Is that a correct interpretation?
Yes. So one way to think about it intuitively is let's consider, okay, so first of all, let me just point toward the AAAI paper that is already available on the web for more details. A basic form of restraint is what's called radial restraint. And there what you do is you restrict the, say, the size of terms that you are going to consider generating conclusions about. And that can itself be specified within the logic. That exactly how to do that is not yet in that AAAI paper, how it's specified within the RULOG logic itself, but is in some other material in a forthcoming RULML paper that will be posted in the next few days. So one way to think about that kind of bounded right, voluntary restraint, we call it, which is, you know, I'm saying, hey, I have a valve that I'm going to turn, you know, like a faucet valve, is that I'm going to skip applying rules when certain higher order conditions are met. Now, they don't have to be higher order conditions, but in this case, it's easiest to think of it as, in general, a higher order guard. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right, Leo.
And just to follow on, I mean, could those be introduced as like kind of pragmas if you called it, you know, so that it executed automatically?
Absolutely. Part of the reason why we say it's a semantically clean approach to the bounded rationality is that in the past, for example, you might say, okay, I want to limit term depth in Prolog. Then you're doing that for a particular query instance in general, a particular run of a particular installation instance of a particular implementation of a particular KR. And it wasn't, so that's not very semantic or interoperable or transportable. Whereas if you put it into the logical language itself and declare it, you're saying, hey, I expect you to get an undefined truth value for this expression just like I get one. So it's fully semantic in that sense.
Okay, good. Let's see, Peter?
It's a great presentation. Thank you very much, Benjamin. I have a question about the technology. How much of it is open and how much of it is proprietary? For example, is Flora 2 totally open source? And for if one uses Flora 2, I mean, what is it that you were showing us that is not doable?
Great question. Thanks a lot, Peter. So the RULOG KRR is basically all of it except certain aspects of omniformity having to do with the treatment of existentials is implemented in Flora, open source. And the restraint is implemented. Not all aspects of it yet are implemented. There's some theory and design beyond what is currently implemented, but the basic radial restraint, which ensures tractability, is implemented at the XSB level and supported at the Flora level. There's certain other aspects of restraint that are implemented and supported at the Flora level. So the basic logic and reasoning in it, with the exception that you need to do your own treatment of existentials and skolemization, is available right now in the version of Flora that's up on SourceForge. We just posted on the Coherent site a new quick start tutorial. There's detailed technical tutorial as well as manual material available for Flora. Flora 2 is available under an Apache license, and XSB is available under an LGPL license, and run on all the major OSs, including Apple, Linux, and Windows. The textual logic approach, which maps from English into RULOG, is proprietary. That was developed by Automata, a little company run by Paul Haley, collaborating with Vulcan and the team there. And there's a patent pending on that, and Coherent was formed to offer that together with services around people who want to use Flora and extensions of it to support full omniformity, knowledge interchange, logical editing UI, et cetera. Now, there's something which right now is in a bit of a limbo, which is that there is a Java layer UI done by Vulkan called the Silk Java layer. There's no team really supporting that anymore, so that's kind of orphan code in that sense, but they are tentatively thinking of making that available for researchers to use. Coherent is working on a new one that will be streamlined, improved, and extended in various ways and supported commercially. Flora and XSB were built on research dollars nickels over many years, XSB over about 20 years, and Flora over about 10 years or so. So they represent quite a lot of investment. To do the other aspects requires getting some revenue to support the development. And as folks probably know, there's not a whole lot of money going into research dollars to pay for especially logic-based KA tools. Even the Protégé group had to discharge its main programmer in the U.S., Martin O'Connor, who worked for Mark Musin, because they couldn't raise even a few hundred thousand dollars to pay for that from the government agencies. So there doesn't seem any choice other than to do this in a proprietary fashion at this point.
That's a good point. And with so much already in the open, I mean, that's phenomenal. And also among the applications of textual logic that you didn't mention, I mean, I would also like you to remember there's a lot of value in working with standards effect between Ontolog and OASIS, OMG, various ISO working groups. There's a ontology-based standards initiative going on, and among the possibilities are, I mean, how could ontology and semantic technology parse all the standards that have been written and make use of semantic technology to do all sorts of things, validation, I mean, all the good things you can think of, and this falls right in there. And obviously, there's if there are open technology that could feed into that effort, I mean, it would be lovely. So we look forward to possibilities of collaborating with you and your colleagues.
That's great. Let me just mention that FIBO, the Financial Industry Business Ontology effort, is one instance of an effort that has to deal with some of this financial reporting and other things around contracts that call for the expressive power of RULOG and the cost effectiveness of being able to start from natural language for a lot of policy or other kind of KA work. And I just want to say that, you know, a lot of ontological knowledge is really mapping knowledge. And RULOG has good power in this way and is kind of closed under, and now we need to map between it type of operation or lifting. It has the meta power. It has. It doesn't have the restrictions that description logic has. And so just like in a dictionary, most of the information is about mappings between words, not just kind of definition of a single word in some kind of reduced way. I believe that a lot of the bulk of ontological knowledge is kind of mapping knowledge, and so it's really good to have a logical KR and a KA approach that can work with it that are both expressively capable and reasonably cost-effective for specifying such mappings.
Great. Thank you.
I think people can work with Flora. You know, our model in Coherent, for example, is freemium, And I think Vibo is very interested in the fact that they could work with an open source tool that implements the great bulk of the expressiveness of RuleLog.
Okay, good. Do we have other questions? I have a number of questions, but I don't want to hog it. Let's see, Amanda in the chat. Amanda apparently had some questions, but she left.
Yeah, go ahead and ask yours.
Okay, yes. Let's see, on slide 7, Benjamin, when you talk about this natural composition, so the mapping between textual phrase and a logical term, that seems to me like you're just chunking the phrase, right, as opposed to doing some sort of compositional semantics that may result in a formula.
Well, at the syntactic level, yes. But then it's pretty straightforward to write axioms that unpack things. And that's how we do question answering with the results of this approach.
So you chunk and then you decompose?
In effect, or you paraphrase, I think is one easy way to think about it. Yeah, so some paraphrasing may involve a simplification or reduction operation. So, for example, you might have a rule that says if prepositional phrase precedes the verb, then the prepositional phrase follows the verb, where that prepositional phrase is acting adverbially. Okay? So when I say if it precedes it, then it follows it, I don't mean literally that. What I mean is if a term that's formed, okay, let me give an example. So I say if some noun walks with difficulty, then that noun with difficulty walks.
Okay.
Okay, so that's an example of paraphrasing. So what I can do is rewrite it even more generally as a default, as a defeasible rule, if noun, verb, adverbial, prepositional phrase, where each of those are variables, then the other ordering, if that those variables had those characteristics of being noun, verb, and adverbial phrase. I'm sorry I can't type into a shared editor here to show you a little example of that.
So you apply
using those types of rules as background rules, you can, with a fairly small number of background rules, do a great deal of powerful manipulation using the high log, et cetera, and defeasibility characteristics of the logic to really have access to the deeper meaning of these phrases, even though you're working with them at the compound level most directly, just at a syntactic level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're able to do kind of transformations.
Exactly. Exactly.
Related to that, and please, folks, raise your hand to ask questions, about intentional context. In other words, propositional attitude. So the example I have here in the chat is something like, John believed that something, that the conclusions were wrong. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to do, the truth of the embedded statement does not necessarily leak to the entire sentence.
Absolutely. So RuLog permits reification. If you look at the Quick Start Guide, it's covered as one of the key features in Flora, for example. In the natural language interpretation certain types of verbs are cues that you're doing modals. So can, should, believe, typically something like think, guess, etc. All right, so there's a relatively small number of such. You can do reasoning about whether to treat something in modal fashion. As I mentioned, because the tool had not been matured, that was one reason for certain shortcomings in expressive coverage, in the KA experiment, that some cases of such modals were not covered yet. But others were, and we believe the approach works quite well for that. There's been a lot of work in the report in the Rural ML conference about use of modals, for example, for deontics, and that's very important in policy. So that's something that already has received considerable attention, and I think it's fairly well understood that the HiLog and reification features can capture modals and allow one to axiomatize the behavior of, in effect, a modal logic, but without resorting to modal logic, you can just embed all that in RULOG, in other words, in higher order syntax itself.
Okay, that's very interesting, yes. We have Brian Howe. Brian, *7.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. Brian Ha with IDA. I was just hoping you could explain a little more about the relationship between Silk and RULOG. Does Silk still exist as a language? Is it being supported by anyone? What are the differences between that and RULOG?
Great question. Okay, so Silk is a bit overloaded as a name. So let me tease apart three things. There was the Silk effort, which developed the logic RULOG, and developed a concrete ASCII syntax for RULOG, which is called .silk syntax, and developed a system for not only reasoning with RULOG, but also certain related functionality, UI for doing logical knowledge acquisition directly in logical expressions, testing, rule editing, as well as some knowledge interchange into OWL, you know, to import OWL, for example, or go out and hit Sparkle endpoints, for example, or import RDF triples, or export RDF triples. That logical UI and knowledge interchange capabilities in a Java layer, and the latest treatment of the existential aspects of RULOG was not yet implemented directly at the floor level when the Silk effort ended. It had a good run, went about 5 years. So basically the Silk logical language is expressively RULOG, but has its own particular syntax, which was a bit different from Flora. Going forward, we believe since Flora is an open source tool and has matured to a good point, it's best to use a syntax based on Flora for RULOG for most communications purposes, and Coherent is working with that. But for interchange at a markup level, to use RIF. So Sandra Hawk from W3C, when I was talking to him at Semtech, suggested that we have a kind of a recommended or sort of lightly recommended ASCII syntax for RULOG as well as the RIF markup syntax. And we both agreed that basing that on Flora would make the most sense. Flora syntax has been modified over the years to based on Silk and to support Silk for obvious reasons, because they were co-developed in support of RULOG.
Okay. So now, what is the difference between the roles of Flora 2 and XSB Prolog? terms of supporting reasoning and whatever else you do?
Okay. Actually, I realized I forgot to answer one other part. So at this point, Silk is, I think, as I mentioned, a bit in limbo from commercialization viewpoint. It's possible Coherent's in discussion with Vulcan to potentially license use of Silk, but it doesn't seem sustainable as a code base in the future, Silk, because of some maintainability issues. And, you know, when you implement things the first time, sometimes you figure out there's better ways to do it later. Flora, XSB is basically a pretty powerful LP system. It does LP, more or less, with a few extensions and bells and whistles, but more or less it's an LP system. Now, it turns out that tabling and the tabling techniques and some of the justifications, some of the reporting to support debugging and radial restraint and certain other aspects of restraint are implemented at the XSB level as well. So in the later years of the HALO Advanced Research, also known as SILC effort, more and more energy was put into doing things at the XSB level because it turned out that some things needed to be tweaked in the guts in that sense. Flora provides a lot of additional expressiveness, high log, frames, defeasibility, and other aspects are all done up at the Flora level. And also the treatment of omnidirectionality, I neglected to mention that that's also a shortcoming of where it handles some aspects and not other aspects of omnidirectionality. It lets one do scolemization, but not automatically. I mean, basically there are scolem functions that are understood to be scolems, but you have to specify them directly, that is manually, when doing KA in Flora. Flora does not have a UI beyond command line. So that's one reason why Coherent is developing such and why there was that in the Silk UI layer. Does that answer your question, or did you have more that you wanted to know about that?
Yeah,
aspect
it's still not clear to me. Apparently, both Flora and XSB obviously does inferencing and reasoning.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
But it sounds like you're saying that XSB has a more limited range of reasoning that it can do.
Yes, its expressiveness is lower. So as I mentioned before, a series of transformations are done, an overall transformation is done that's composed of those sub-transformations from RULOG into LP. The result is spit into XSB for execution, although Flora is present at dynamically to take care of certain aspects as well at execution time. Flora is written in XSB, so it runs essentially as an XSB program.
Okay. So Flora basically calls XSB, rather?
That's right. So Flora transforms stuff into XSB form, but also runs and does some other stuff dynamically and calls XSB, exactly. So Flora, in that sense, sits on top of XSB, and the Java layer of Silk sits on top of Flora, but is not really available right now, although things are afoot on that front, especially to make it available for non-commercial research purposes.
Okay. But you're saying Coherent is working on a different interface to work on top of Flora, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. That helps me understand that a lot better. Thank you.
Sure. Look on the Coherent site soon. Probably next week we'll have a stack diagram that will explain some of these issues. Mm-hmm. But if you look at some of the previous past Silk presentations that are up on the Silk website, you'll see stack diagrams of the Silk system that will give you some sense of that architecture as well.
All right.
Okay, folks, we probably have time for one more question. I actually see that Steve had a comment. And maybe Harold responded, but Steve, did you want to make your point? I don't know. Is Steve Ray on, star 7?
Okay, sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
It was really just a very minor point. I'm not sure it really merits discussion, but I had noticed in your discussions, your presentations of some of these examples, like the hydrophobic tail of whatever it was, you had, and it's probably a UI question, in the, let's see, the formula section, the lower half of the screen, it seemed to drop the whole hydrophobic constraint altogether, and I was wondering what happened to that. But then you had this reading section, which seemed to have it again. So I was just wondering, did it lose some of that constraint information, or is it that just somehow the intermediate?
Okay, yeah. Steve, that's an excellent question. You know, it's hard to get into all the details of how the logical disambiguation works here, but what we're looking at in the middle for doing the disambiguation is stuff that's focused on kind of the key nouns, essentially, because it turns out that that's a good way to organize doing the quantifier disambiguation and coreference aspect of disambiguation, which this phase overall, the two phases of the disambiguation are dealing with here. So you don't need to see hydrophobic hanging off there. But it is a modifier on tails, and so you see it show up in the reading, in other words, in the output
sort of get
logic.
The basic structure, and then you redecorate it later, if you like.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So you're just kind of looking at the skeleton in the middle there that is important for working with to do the disambiguation of the quantification and coreference specifically.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. And I just want to remind people, I encourage you to look at it's a very short mini demo video, I think it's less than 2 minutes, that's up on the Coherence site under the white paper section and publications part of the Coherence site that shows how this disambiguation gets done.
Okay,
folks, I think we're near the end. I'd like to thank Benjamin for a very interesting talk and for everyone for participating. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening and attending. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay,
take care.
Bye-bye.